Learn to code, build apps, inspire the next generation.
Welcome to the Swift App School podcast, where we are empowering the next generation of app developers.
I'm Charles Long, co-founder of Swift App School.
And I'm Bob Williams, co-founder of Swift App School.
All right, well, welcome to episode 7 of the Swift App School podcast. How you doing, Charles?
Pretty good. How are you?
Pretty good. Today we're going to discuss our experience presenting at a recent homeschool conference, the Great Homeschool Conference in South Carolina, Apple's peak performance March event, and something cool at the end. And just also wanted to mention we've got our app camp coming up July the 11th through the 15th. We're excited to have students from around the Southeast probably attending, primarily from Asheville, North Carolina. That's where we'll be hosted. And we've got the Hatch Innovation Hub letting us use their space here in downtown Asheville. So we're excited about hosting that once again.
Okay, we're going to start out with the first topic, which is our experience presenting at the Great Homeschool Conference. My wife has been homeschooling for about 15 years or so. We have four daughters and all of them are in homeschool. And so we've been attending these conferences off and on. I've been to a couple, and at some point, maybe it was 3 or 4 years ago, my wife said, "You guys need to set up a vendor booth at this conference." And we finally decided to take that opportunity and register for the conference as vendors instead of just attendees. So that was a great experience. Fortunately, we've had some experience with speaking at conferences, so we didn't feel out of place doing that. But it was a different experience because we really wanted to figure out what type of market the homeschool market would be, or figure out whether there was any general interest in coding at all. We weren't sure. But I just recognized the last time I attended one of these conferences, there was only one or two people that were talking about STEM and technology or coding or robotics or electronics. So I thought there was a great opportunity for us to advertise the camp.
This is the first time I'd ever been to a homeschool conference. And homeschooling has gotten really sophisticated now. There's so many choices and lots of people were there as vendors as well. But yeah, like you said, there weren't a lot of STEM opportunities. And it was interesting seeing when we started our presentation, I think a lot of the kids in the audience came up afterwards. They were excited. It was funny because a couple of them, you know, I think they were wanting us to kind of bust out into app camp afterwards and start the camp. So we were like, no, that's going to have to wait till the summer. But yeah, it was really, they were very eager to learn coding and something more than just Scratch and what's on code.org. And so, you know, it really gave us more excitement knowing, okay, there's a lot of interest here. Now we just need to, you know, teach more kids. So that was great. It was also funny because it's been a while since I've presented in person and in front of a group. And that's one of my, you know, it's still not easy to get up in front of, you know, 100 people and talk when you're not doing it every day, because I am introverted, so by nature. And so, I noticed after the talk, I went, whoa, my Apple Watch is going off. It gave me some heart notifications. And then I realized it was about 5 minutes before we were going to go on that I was getting that notification. So, yeah,
you might have been a little bit nervous because I was running late in traffic coming from Asheville.
Yeah.
You might have been getting a little bit nervous that I wasn't going to show up on time.
That's right. That didn't help. So didn't help with my nerves. But yeah, we got through it. It was a lot of fun. And it was nice just to have some great feedback from the parents and from the students as well, because I think they all are really eager. A lot of the parents, you know, kind of echoed what we've heard before at App Camp is, you know, parents come in and say, we don't know how to help them with STEM and with coding. And we're so glad that you're here to help them learn, you know, app development. And so that's why we do this. And we're hoping we can scale this up even more in the future and teach more people.
And actually, I don't know if we talked about this, but we were vendors, but we also had a keynote speech that we gave about coding is a superpower. So that's what Bob is referring to. And it was an opportunity for us to give a little bit of our backstory, but then talk about what we've done in the past with App Camp and how we're able to bring in these students and give them an opportunity to learn, and then where we're headed in the future. And I think that's where people got excited, because they thought that our online curriculum was ready today. And so that was the number one request by almost every family that walked up. Like, yep. We can't get to Asheville, but where's that curriculum? So it definitely put a spotlight on what we need to focus on next. And, you know, it's difficult because we both have full-time jobs and we're trying to build this on the side. But we do have, as we mentioned before, we have technical curriculum developers that are having a great time creating content, learning how to develop games that will soon turn into online tutorials. So that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, I mean, we had parents come up to us who are from Louisiana. There were some from California that had just recently moved to the Southeast. And so they weren't all in the, hardly any of them were really in the Asheville area. But they were all really wanting to learn our curriculum, and they were wanting us to teach App Camp in their community. So, yeah, lots of opportunities there. Hopefully we can have this virtual platform up before we know it, but it's going to take a little bit of time. We'll get there though.
And one of the ideas that my wife gave, which was a really good idea, was to have a raffle as a carrot, I guess, to entice people to stop by the booth. We had an iPad giveaway. We did have a winner that showed up, and the mother with two daughters, I believe, and she was pretty excited for the iPad. And we were able to tell her, if you want to start coding now, look at Swift Playgrounds for the iPad, and you can develop full apps on it now. And so we just gave her that and a couple of resources and told her to reach out if she has any questions. And so it was a great conference. We enjoyed it. We were able to use this as an opportunity for us to really focus on what's the next steps for Swift App School.
Yeah, and it was nice because we could sit at the booth, and when we started talking about what we did at App Camp, all I had to do was just pull out my iPad and show a couple of tutorials from the past. Like, we had some clone games that we'd done way back when, like a Fruit Ninja clone that Jack had done. We also did an AR app last year with facial recognition, so that, you know, when you're blinking your eyes, it would blink the 3D eyes of whatever face you built. So that was pretty cool for them to kind of see that, live and up close, on their own face. And, all of them were like, oh, wow, I want to build this. So, yeah, so it was exciting.
One of the other things that I didn't know about was the fact that South Carolina has a requirement in their curriculum for coding. And that's so right. I don't know what other cities have this requirement, or if it's actually statewide. I'm assuming it's statewide.
It's statewide. Yeah, okay. I think it is.
So that's obviously not a North Carolina requirement, but I like that it's a requirement in South Carolina. I think it's only a matter of time before most of the states will require it.
Yep.
So that bears good news for us.
It does. I mean, they really need to do this on a national level. I'd love to see, the federal government get involved in that and say, hey, coding needs to be taught everywhere. Because it really does. I mean, if you think about the future of education, I mean, if you're not teaching coding, then something's wrong.
I think the issue they're having is the fact that there's a shortage of teachers.
Yeah.
And I think once they are able to provide access to resources financially to support teachers, I think then it will be a requirement. Yep. I think first they got to address the need of, okay, where are we going to get teachers from?
Yeah. So, and we have to give the schools a break because, I mean, we've been living through a pandemic. So, I mean, it's not like they've had an easy couple of last 2 years. So I'm not suggesting they should have had that, 2 years ago. But now that it's kind of, you're seeing that parents are seeing the importance of it. Parents are seeing that their own kids light up with technology and they don't know how to address it and they don't know where to find any resources. I think that's the need that's becoming more and more apparent.
Okay, Apple in the news. So Apple just recently wrapped up what they call peak performance, their March event where they announced new hardware. And this year, the hardware upgrades were the new iPhone SE, which is their smaller iPhone. And they announced a new iPad Air, a brand new processor, the Apple M1 Ultra, and the Mac Studio and Studio Display. So I want to cover some of those hardware announcements and what that means for Apple and what that means for consumers. So starting with the iPhone SE, the iPhone SE is basically special edition. So it's the iPhone that basically fills the void where they've upgraded their phones to fit that bigger style. So of course, anything that's 6 inches or above, you get, like in this case, the iPhone 13, mm-hmm. and iPhone 13 Pro and iPhone 13 Pro Max at this time are the current flagship phones. But the SE is that smaller one that still uses the body that's like the iPhone 7 and 8 form factor.
It still has the home button too, right?
And it still has a home button, yes.
Which is what my dad says. I want the home button.
So a lot of people, you know, don't want to move away from that device. So if they, you know, get rid of that device, then all of a sudden they're missing an entire market. So Apple's realized, okay, we need to keep a low budget phone. And the iPhone SE is that phone. But what's cool about it is if you were to wait for the upgrade to the iPhone SE this particular year, this is version 3, it's actually a pretty good upgrade considering, you know, if you think about like your dad or somebody who's, they don't want the latest and greatest. They want a phone that works. It's not too big. It doesn't cost a lot of money. It's upgraded to the A15 Bionic chip. So that's the one that's in the iPhone 13 and 13 Pro, 13 Pro Max. So they're getting the same exact processor. It has 5G, so you get the same, you know, data speeds, and it has longer battery life than the previous model. This is a very good upgrade for the people that, you know, want to stay below $600 for their phone.
And they don't get the, you know, they just don't get the facial recognition that's essentially what they're missing out on.
Yeah, Face ID is not on it, but you get a solid phone now. I mean, sometimes people argue the SE is the hand-me-down or the old, you know, that's the old technology, but now this is the same processor, same 5G, and a little bit better battery life. Now, you don't get the high-quality screen that you get on the 13 Pro. Not that it's not a high-quality screen, but you're not getting that vibrant LED technology. So you're still getting the old, what they call IPS screen. Most people don't really know the difference. I mean,
let's be honest. Most people don't need a Pro, and especially a 13 Pro. So I think the SE for most people is probably a good enough phone for what they're using it for.
I'd say that the only reason you want to have a better phone is if you care a lot about the night vision or you need a lot of widescreen shots. Mm-hmm. And you like, you want to get those widescreen shots or you want to have the telephoto lens. If you don't really care about that, then you should be pretty set with the iPhone SE. iPhone SE 3 is a very good upgrade for those people. Moving on to the iPad Air. So the iPad Air is a very interesting one for me. Both the iPad Air and the iPad Mini are interesting for me. But I'm going to talk about the iPad Air because that was the recent upgrade in this event. The iPad Air kind of sits between the regular iPad at $300 or $329 and the iPad Pro, which is roughly $700 to $900, depending on which model you get. So it sits in between those two, and it is compatible with the Apple Pencil 2, so you have the advantage of magnetically charging it, and then you have a smaller form factor than you do with the iPad Pro, because this is a little bit heavier and a little bit larger screen. The iPad Air is very thin, and it sits in that, $500 range? I didn't even look at the price of the iPad Air. So I forget exactly what it is. We can look it up here in a minute. But let's see. iPad Air is currently, checking out the price here on their website. So the iPad Air, if you just get the basic model, so I'm going to pick one, 64 gigs of RAM, Wi-Fi, $599. So you're right there at the $600 price range. Whereas if you were to go up to the iPad Pro, you're looking at, I think, $700 or $800 for the base model. You know, that's why, to me, the iPad Air is, sort of the in-between. I guess if I don't pay $300, if I really care about the faster screen, the faster processor, and the Apple Pencil 2, I just jumped all the way to the Pro.
Yeah, I think I would do that too. I'm not, I mean, I can see how some people might not want to spend as much on the Pro. But I will say, I mean, of the iPad Air versus the Mini, I actually like the Mini better.
Yeah, because it's smaller.
Because it's smaller. You can, like, you know, for reading books and things, it's really nice. It's a nice weight. It's a nice size. So, I mean, I happen to have one of the new iPad Minis, and I like it for a lot of reasons. There's sometimes when I just wish I had a bigger screen, but I just pull out my laptop when I need that. So, for the most part, it's great. I mean, it's really great for using the Apple Pencil, for drawing. That's kind of primarily why I wanted it. I just wanted something that I could use because for a while I didn't even have an iPad. And I didn't really need a Pro because I've got a laptop. So I just figured I'll take the M1 laptop and then just have the Mini. And so far that's worked pretty well.
Speaking of the M1, the iPad Air upgraded to the M1 chip. So I think this made it a little more intriguing because you are getting that better processor for less than, you know, $700-$800. You're going to get the M1 chip. I'm not exactly sure when they're going to take advantage of the M1 chip in the iPad Air and the iPad Pro. I think they have a long-term plan in mind. They just haven't unveiled it because they announced this in the iPad Pro last year. The iPad Air has the M1 chip, but there's been no conversation about why that's important. People thought when the M1 came to the iPad Pro, they got really excited. They thought that all the Apple apps were going to jump right over into the iPad Pro, and it didn't happen.
It's almost like the glasses are going to use them somehow. I don't know.
Yeah, it could be that they're filling all their devices with M1 to get some testing to see how much power they can, you know, how efficient they can run the M1 chip down to. It really wouldn't surprise me if all of their iPads end up with the M1 chip, because then you have iPads and laptops running apps across the board, meaning iPad OS apps can run on the Mac. We know that. I think being able to have the same exact chip means there's really no difference between the iPad and the Mac anymore. They keep arguing that they're not going to combine the operating systems, but we'll see. That's to be determined. The other thing the iPad Air did was add a 5G option. So if you want to upgrade and have data, you've got 5G on the iPad Air. So I can see, you know, I already have an iPad Pro and I've got that 120Hz screen. The iPad Air does not have that. So I can see if you don't care about that, you can pay less money, like I mentioned, and get the iPad Air. And it also supports the Apple Magic Keyboard. So yeah, there are some benefits for the iPad Air. And that fits those particular people who want to get it at that price point. Next, I want to move to the Apple M1 Ultra. So we mentioned that back in 2020, Apple introduced their own M1 processor and went away from Intel. And ever since then, they've been on a tear. I mean, everybody thought it was a joke that Apple's going to make their own processor because they said, oh, the iPad is not a true processor. So Apple said, watch this. And ever since then, they've been going through this process that they talked about that would take 2 years, which is transitioning away from Intel. We're at the end of that 2 years, and this is the second to last device that has that particular processor. We'll talk about that in a minute, that being the desktop computers that they have. Basically, they just introduced a new computer that we'll talk about in just a minute. But first, this M1 Ultra processor is basically an M1 Max with a secret. So it's interesting how they announced this, but they said the M1 Max has been incredible as a processor. It's so fast. You know, the M1 Pro was the chip that they introduced alongside the M1 Max. The M1 Pro beat pretty much every other laptop processor. In Apple's words, performance per watt, which basically means if I unplug the laptop, it still runs just as fast and it doesn't use that much power. You can get 15 to 20 hours of battery life while still doing high intensity tasks on your laptop. That's with the M1 Pro, and M1 Max. Well, the M1 Max apparently has this technology where you can combine two together and basically create one new processor. So that's what they did. So by combining two, they came up with the M1 Ultra, which is insane because the M1 Max was already wiping every other processor off the shelf with its performance per watt. Now, that doesn't mean like, oh, this is the best processor ever invented. It just means that for the amount of power that you're consuming, which is not very much, you're getting a ton of power. So you're getting a lot for your money. And then they just created the M1 Ultra processor. And so it's pretty amazing. They've got some crazy specs on their on these websites talking about it. And I mean, you can relate to the Mac Pro, or not the Mac Pro, but was it a Mac Pro that you had? That was a Mac Pro, wasn't it? The Intel Mac Pro that you used to have with how many cores?
It had like 12 cores.
Yeah, people thought that was insane.
Yeah, I remember that. I remember I ordered it and the guy at Apple was like, you don't need this many cores. And I was like, well, I do a lot of video work and I use Maya and, you know, then I started talking about everything that I use it on. So, okay, that yeah, I guess you might need it. So.
Well, with that in mind, I mean, the M1 Ultra is a 20-core GPU.
Yeah.
Which is 16 high-performance cores and 4 high-efficiency cores. So to compare that to the M1 Max, which came before it, which I have in my laptop. See, now I got to get rid of my laptop and get that new device. No, I'm kidding. No, but this is basically double everything my laptop is. I have a 10-core CPU and a 8-core, basically I have 8 high-performance cores and 2 high-efficiency cores. That gives me my 10. But this doubles everything. What's amazing about this, if you understand processors or if you don't understand processors, basically anytime that you have multiple cores, what ends up happening is your software has to be rewritten so it understands that you have two brains and that you can utilize those dual cores or multiple cores. Mm-hmm. In this case, the way Apple wrote it is they stripe these two together and it becomes one processor. And the computer's macOS software or any software doesn't know there's another processor. It just sees that it has a lot more power. So all of a sudden, you just get that much more power without doing any changes to your code. That's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, you'd think that you need to work at Pixar or something in order to get this kind of power, I mean, in order to need this kind of power. But, I mean, now everybody wants it.
Yeah, and I think this is not for everybody, but, I mean, what they did, which is a great segue into what is this processor in, it was introduced in the Mac Studio. Mm-hmm. And the Mac Studio essentially is a Mac Mini on steroids. And so the Mac Mini, everybody knows, that's kind of like the entry device people get when they're interested in a Mac because it's roughly $600 to $700 and you add your own monitor, keyboard, and mouse to it. The Mac Studio, same idea, but it looks like a lot thicker. It's, what is it, like, I didn't even look at the specs, but it's like 4 to 6 inches tall or something like that. It's much, much taller than the Mac Mini. Sits on the desk. And they actually have an AR app that you can use to see how it looks on your desk.
Oh, do they really?
On the website, you can click on and you can actually place it on your desk. They're making it easy for you to see it.
That's pretty cool.
In your office.
That's pretty nice.
But we have some words about the design. It's a little interesting. Yeah. What do you think about that design? It's just a gray box.
I
want to
talk about the design because it's a missed opportunity, Apple. Come on. I mean, everybody remembers the Happy Mac, and you see it on their Finder every day. Why didn't they just make a little smiley face out of the SD card slot?
Well, they can't the curl it. They can't
well,
curl
they could,
it.
But they could have put some artwork there so it looks like a smiley face. I mean, come on. That would have been so creative and so cool. But instead, it looks like, I don't know what it looks like. It just looks strange.
I think a lot of people were bashing the design, being more of a critic than we are, because they said, look at the Mac Pro. Even though it looks like a cheese grater, it was iconic.
Yeah.
It looks so good. You look at it, you're like, yeah, that looks very, very nice. The quality is so nice. And then you look at this box, and it's pretty bland. And
it's like you want to hide it somewhere.
Yeah, and I don't know. Maybe that's what they were thinking about with the design. They want to, I don't know. I mean, I feel like it was a missed opportunity, too. There could have been some more design done to it, but I don't know.
I mean, you know, it's still a nice machine. and the monitor, I mean, everybody wants the monitor, so, you know.
Yeah, the monitor is another weird one. I'm going to talk about that in a second, because I do want to say that the Mac Studio is an amazing piece of machine, though, because it has all the ports. So
yeah, at least they left the ports on there. You don't have to get a dongle. That would have been really bad.
Yeah, I think people are pretty happy about that. It has four USB-C ports. And I didn't actually check to see if this is a 10 gigabit Ethernet or not. There may be an option for it. I need to double check that. It has Ethernet on the back. It has, of course, the power connector. It's got two USB-A ports. So that's the traditional USB. Mm-hmm. And then it's got HDMI still on it.
That's good.
Some people are arguing that Apple should have put HDMI 2.1, which is the latest standard on. But they're like, no, most people are going to connect a high 4K, 5K screen up. So they're going to use Thunderbolt. They're just being nice and giving you HDMI. And then they have the low impedance headphone jack. So that's nice.
That's nice.
Because it is a studio device. Yeah, so you should have the capability to plug in the studio headphones.
That's right.
Ventilation in the back. I just think my idea in regards to design, it's just basic.
Yeah.
It seems like it would have done a little extra with the design, but it's a very, very powerful device. Some people that got it early were complaining that you couldn't take it apart, but Apple was pretty ingenious with their design. And I think you just take the rubber off the bottom of it. So it's a square cubic looking device, but under the bottom, there's a ring under it. There's a rubber foot, I guess you could call it. You can peel that off and it exposes the screws and you can take it out. Now, I'm hearing now that people are reviewing it that you really can't change out some of the hardware, which doesn't surprise me because that's kind of what Apple does. They don't really want you to tamper with their devices, change out the default hardware for something else. But, you know, people are testing these as we speak, so I don't know what the final verdict is on what you can and can't take out of it. But I'm sure iFixit will have information soon about that. But in terms of power, I've seen some comparisons and Apple put out their own claims about it. I'm going to go back and look at some of the claims of the chip that they're running in the Mac Studio. They're saying it's 60% faster than the Mac Pro. Now, the Mac Pro starts at $6,000 base price.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen people configure it up to $50,000.
Wow.
And they're saying that the Mac Studio running with the M1 Ultra compares to the Mac Pro. It's 60% faster than the one with 28 cores.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fast.
Whew. They're saying it's 90% faster than the Mac Pro that has 16 cores. They said it uses 200 watts less power on GPU or graphics performance compared to the highest end GPU, which would be NVIDIA. So if you're a gamer using NVIDIA, they're saying it used 200 watts less power.
Okay.
That doesn't matter so much when you're plugging it in, but where it does matter is if you are playing games on a laptop or you're doing video editing or photo editing and you unplug. Typically when you unplug, you're getting 2 hours, 2.5 hours on a PC. And on this, you're using 200 watts less power. So you can just use it for 10 hours or more.
Yeah.
You know, as far as this M1 Ultra, it is a weird thing to talk about because, again, you're not going to unplug the M1.
Yeah, you're not going to unplug the
Mac Studio.
Yeah, that's true.
But I guess if you're trying to keep, you know, if you just want to say, hey, you're not going to be paying as high of an electric bill, then that's where it matters. Mm-hmm. So just kind of showing you at the amount of efficiency they've been able to achieve is something that Apple can stick their chest out about and say, look what we've done. And then, of course, they teased at the last bit that we've been on a 2-year transition and we only have one machine left, and that's the Mac Pro. And I thought they were going to announce a new Mac Pro right then, and they said, but that'll have to wait till another day. So there's only one device left, and I'm really curious how they're going to handle that.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. People have been making funny memes of a taller Mac Studio.
I mean, I'm wondering if they're trying to phase out the Mac Mini and just make this the replacement?
I don't think so, because okay. This starts at this starts at $2,000 for the base model. And then that's the M1 Pro. Yeah. The M1 Ultra processor is $4,000. So yeah, this is not meant for people at home that just want a Mac. This is definitely living up to his name of Studio. So.
And that monitor does look really nice. But so what's wrong with the monitor?
So I have an LG Ultrafine monitor. It's a 5K monitor. And I think it's $1,200. $1,200 to $1,300. This is $1,600.
Hmm.
And it has the same exact specs. This monitor looks nicer because it's Apple. It's silver.
Yeah.
It's elegant. It doesn't wobble. Okay. It's not cheap plastic.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you knew this, it's actually running the same processor as the iPad from a couple years ago. Huh. It has an A13 Bionic chip in the monitor.
In the monitor?
Yeah.
Really?
People are calling it the giant iPad.
Okay.
So it does center stage, where if you walk around, the camera follows you just like the Mac does.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
So people that have the old monitors that can't do center stage, now you can.
That's cool.
And it has the same speakers as this MacBook Pro, but I've heard it's actually better than this MacBook Pro, which has the best laptop speakers. So they're saying this monitor has better speakers.
Huh. Okay,
that matters. Like, okay, that's worth $1,600.
Yeah.
But then I had a day to go home and think about it. And I had a chance to look at some of the YouTube channels that are talking about it. And the problem is, it's kind of like the Mac Studio design.
Yeah.
There's some missed opportunities. For one, if you're in a studio, obviously you don't really want to pay $5,000 for the bigger monitor, the 32-inch. Mm-hmm. This is a 27-inch monitor, but it does not have LED.
Hmm.
And when you're doing photo editing, I've heard people say that you really want to have that higher, vibrant color.
I can see that.
So it's not a real HDR screen like you would expect to pay.
Yeah, exactly.
You look at the competitors, you can get a screen that's 4 to 5K.
Yeah.
Or really, you can get another screen that's 4K. If you don't really care about 4K versus 5K,
mm-hmm.
you can get 4K monitors for $900. $900 is a lot of money, but...
Yeah.
You know, 900 or 1600.
1600, yeah. Is it really worth it for the sound when you probably already have good headphones or whatever? So do you really need that speaker? And, you know, they also missed an opportunity because they could have put a separate stand that costs $1,000, but they didn't do that.
Well, they do have a stand with this one.
I'm just kind of joking. Remember the $1,000 stand?
Yeah. Well, here's what they did. So this is odd. This one comes with a stand, unlike the Pro Display XDR. But that monitor never was for people like us.
Yeah,
it's for the people that need reference monitors that cost $15,000, $20,000. That was just a marketing mistake on Apple's part to announce the stand was $1,000. Anyway, this monitor comes with a stand that's not movable.
Hmm.
You can tilt it, but you can't slide the monitor up and down.
Okay, got it.
And reposition the monitor very much.
Okay.
But if you pay $400 more dollars, if you pay $400 more dollars, you can get one that looks like the one that comes with the Pro Display XDR that lets you tilt it and lift up and down.
Interesting.
It looks pretty similar to it. The difference is it doesn't click magnetically onto it.
Okay. Can you hang it on the wall? I guess you could.
No, not that stand.
I mean, no, but can you hang this?
Oh, yeah, you can. So then there's another option. If you pay, I don't know what it is, to look on the site.
Another $400. Well, put it on the wall.
They have a vase amount, and I can't remember. I'd have to look and see if it's $200. Is that what it is?
Apple's gotten to the point now where you pretty much... You can't buy anything at Apple for less than $400. It's kind of like when I go to Starbucks, I can't get a coffee for less than $5. So.
Yeah.
Or maybe $10 now. I don't know.
When people talk about Apple and pricing, I understand. I'm like, it's not for everybody.
Yeah.
It's when you want to have that great first impression. It's when you want to look at it like you do a Mercedes. Like, do people need a Mercedes? Do people need Acura? Not really. You can buy a Honda. You can buy a Toyota.
Mm-hmm.
It's totally fine. But some people just want that brand new Acura, that brand new Mercedes, or they want in Apple's case, maybe a Rolls Royce. Because you can, and it looks nice. And so some of the competitors have better specs. They don't look as nice or sound as nice. and their camera on this new monitor is very nice. So there's some things that make you want this monitor. It looks so good. It pairs so well with any Apple device, but you're going to pay $1,600 for it. And if you want that extra, if you don't want the basic stand, you're paying $400 more. So now at $2,000, you could buy a really high quality Dell or Samsung or LG. Right. So yeah. I don't know. I'm not going to say I won't buy one, but
are they ever going to make the Apple TV that everybody used to talk about? They were going to make a monitor and everything.
I think they will. And I think this is the first step because it has that chip inside of it. Yeah, everybody's wondering what's that chip doing inside that monitor.
Yeah, this is the test.
And if they were to do that and say, oh, by the way, this new Apple TV now has this, or I should say this new cinema, or not cinema, I'm going backwards. The new studio display can now run Apple TV apps. Yep. It has the same processor. That's I guarantee true. You they're going to flip a switch and all of a sudden that $1,600 is going to be worth it.
You're right. Yeah, that's going to happen. Totally.
I can see that happening because that's what everybody's wondering. Why is there an A13 Bionic processor inside of the...
Well, and then they're going to take the old HomePods and hook them up to the monitors. So you want real sound.
I mean, from what I hear, the sound is really good, you know, so it's already amazing. I'm like, that has all the ingredients to be exactly what you said it was going to be. Yeah. There's only one other gripe I've heard about this monitor, and I don't know why they did this. The cable can't disconnect from
the
monitor.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Why?
I don't know.
Apple, why?
It cannot. I saw one person really yank it out, and I don't know. It was just a quick snippet of someone else's video, so they yanked it out. I don't know if they could put it back. I mean, it's the one thing that everybody's talking about is that you cannot remove the cable. And everybody's mad because they said the iMac is magnetically connected. So they're like,
yeah, you would think they...
What's the deal?
But well, there's probably an internal reason that we'll never know why.
Well, one thing they did talk about, that is a good point. One person said, if you look at the iMac, the power is on the outside. So they have a very small magnetic connector on the back, but then they have a brick down on the floor that has Ethernet in it too.
Yeah.
And it's an extension. So the question is, why didn't they just use that same...
Yeah, they could have used the same design.
...cable. I'm not sure.
Maybe it has something to do with the chip that's in there. I don't know.
I don't know. I don't think so. But I mean, if it does become an Apple TV replacement or like another, it makes me wonder if that's what they're going to do. Like they want the cable to be stationary. So it could, I don't know. It just seems like a missed opportunity that they could have.
They're going to say, we heard a lot of complaints. Now we're going to add an Apple TV to the, the plug.
Yeah.
I don't know. All right, well, I guess we're getting to the Something Cool segment now, which is the end of our podcast. And we have some exciting news. We've got a guest coming on, our first guest for a podcast that we just found out, 2 weeks ago? And it's a pretty big guest, very big guest, very big Apple person. So this is exciting. Drum roll, please. Guy Kawasaki.
Yay.
He's the chief evangelist, or was the chief evangelist of Apple. Today, he's the chief evangelist of Canva and the creator of what I consider, and I think many people should consider, the world's best podcast, the Remarkable People podcast. If you have not heard that podcast, you should definitely check it out. It is very, very good. And there's one episode in particular that, I mean, there's several that I really, really, really like. But Steve Wozniak's interview early on, I think it's one of the first 10 interviews he had. Jane Goodall was the first one. But they're just some really good, really good interviews with amazing people. And we're excited to have him on our podcast, of all places. I reached out to him on Twitter, and now he's going to be on. So this is great. He's written 11 books, including Wise Guy, The Art of the Start 2.0, The Art of Social Media. I mean, he's an amazing speaker. You've probably seen him on stage or seen him on YouTube talking to a group of tech enthusiasts. And yeah, he's got a lot of wisdom, and we're really excited to have him on the podcast. So Guy Kawasaki. First guest.
Yes.
and we'll have him on soon.
That is pretty exciting. I'm always amazed when you reach out to people and get these responses. Usually when I get an email or a text from you, I can feel the excitement. And I know this one's pretty amazing. Just looking at Guy's body of work, and the podcast is really inspiring. I enjoy it as well. You typically send me episodes that you thought were very inspiring and can help us in our journey. And that is really exciting for us to have him on our podcast. I really like that. One of the videos that I really enjoyed watching from Guy Kawasaki was when he attended one of the tech conferences, and he was the host, I believe, and Steve Ballmer was there from Microsoft. And I remember the guy asked him, like, it was one of the first questions, I believe, like, so why didn't you hire me at Microsoft? And I think it made Steve Ballmer feel really uncomfortable. I bet. And that was Microsoft's loss, because Apple scooped him up, and God did great work for Apple. So sorry, Microsoft, you missed out on that opportunity. But I thought that was hilarious. That's one of those videos I got to go dig up and watch again. I thought it was really cool. And that was probably my first introduction to Guy Kawasaki, was seeing that. And I was like, oh, who is this guy? This guy, I like him. That's really cool. So, yeah, obviously at that point I was all like just everything Apple. So I was watching every video that had anyone related to Apple in it. And so that one was hilarious.
Yeah.
I'll have to send you the link to that. I will put that video in the show notes so people can see it.
Yeah. I think I read The Art of the Start, but not the 2.0 version. I read that one way back when. I remember getting it at the library years ago. And then I also remember hearing he was on a podcast. I think it might have been like The Startup Grind or something, where they interviewed him. He was, you know, talking about MVP and just the importance of minimal viable product when you're in a startup, and, you know, just ship it. Don't worry about it being perfect. Just get it out there. Mm-hmm. So that really stuck with me. He's got great, great business advice.
Yeah, I just pulled up my YouTube channel. I've got some of his videos saved in my business research and inspirational speaking. And one of them is one that you talk about a lot. I'm sure he's got some lessons from Steve Jobs. So that was one of the videos.
Yeah.
There was a couple of who to hire, ideas, what makes them successful, make meaning in your company, make a great pitch. And so, you know, as Guy is a venture and lives in that venture world, he has a lot of very solid advice for startups that are trying to figure out what's the most important thing to focus on. Like, how do I make a pitch deck?
Yeah.
And, you know, do I need to go into a lot of information and have like long drawn out pitch decks? No.
Yeah.
Like, I think he's the one that talks about having like 12 slides or whatever, having like very succinct slides and stuff like that. So,
I think it was like 6 slides or something. It's a lot less than what we typically do.
So. Yeah, I know. And we have the tendency to say, let's just cram it full. They got to know everything.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, we're really excited to have Guy come on the podcast. What better guest can you have as a first?
Oh, yeah. It's a great first guest.
Yeah.
We wanted to, hit a home run on the first guest, and we certainly have. So we're excited and look forward to that interview.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of the Swift App School podcast.
You can always find us online at swiftappschool.com. And we're also on social media at Swift App School on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, YouTube, and Facebook. Bye, y'all.
Goodbye.